Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Happiness is just around the corner. Just come to San Francisco. They have a conference on happiness and its causes. It's only $545 for a three-day pass to learn from these goofballs how to be happy. They divide happiness into 16 emotions, including personality traits such as optimism and cheerfulness. Hey, according to this jerk who's running the conference, the moods consists of optimism and cheerfulness. Well, you won't find that in me. State of mania, maybe. Moods of euphoria and contentment. Yeah, right. Sensory pleasures such as visual, gustatory, and auditory. And three states of mind with no English translation. Schadenfreude. Ooh, that's so advanced. Like I never heard of Schadenfreude. How PC. Schadenfreude, German for feeling good about the pain of your enemies, like I haven't talked about that. Naches. You got naches. That's Yiddish for joy and offspring's accomplishments. And fiero, Italian for what you feel when you've met a challenge. I never heard of that one. Who ever heard of fiero? I never heard of this. Naches doesn't mean joy at an offspring's accomplishment. This is like a goy telling you what naches means. This is a non-German telling you what Schadenfreude means. This is a non-Buddhist telling you what Buddhism is. You hear this? This is really stupidity. These people are so stupid and clueless, they belong in Obama's transition team. This idiot says, I believe we can understand life a lot better if we make distinctions, not by just saying, I'm not happy. Ooh, hey, there's a Pulitzer in this one. Wow. Like I haven't told you for years that we are stuck with one word for love. This is not from the article. Let me put the article down. I know it was written by skillful fools who can con idiots. I can't imagine. I like to go to the conference just to see the morons who show up on how to be happy. You could just imagine the bag ladies are going to show up. Oof, God, it's horrible to see human frailty. I don't like to mock people. Believe me, I do it only because I have to. I don't really want to do it. But if it wasn't for the foibles of mankind, I'd be out of business. You know what I'm saying? That's why Voltaire stayed in Paris, was to mock the foibles of the Parisians in his time. And look, there's a statue of him in any museum. I think it was the same picture of him in the chair, the same sculpture of him in a chair. And when I was a youngster and did the big trip to Europe, I remember seeing it in the Louvre. Maybe several were done, who knows. What an incredible thing that is. You die and they sculpt you in a chair forever. Maybe someone will sculpt me with a microphone. You get to know. Here's the thing that bothers me about dying. I didn't mean to get into this, but I want to get into it for a second. I keep thinking about it in this way. Here's what I can't understand. Let's say there is a heaven and hell. Okay, let's just say for the minute there is. You're punished if you were bad, so be good for goodness sake. Oh, you better not shout. You better not pout. Telling you why Santa Claus is coming to town. But let's say you suspend whatever and you're old already and scared and you start to believe in, and you go to heaven with the gold chair and the Kanisha's waiting for you, whatever, and your mother's cooking. And you believe that. But if you're bad, you go to the other place. All right. Now, here's the thing. Let's say there's reincarnation. I'm trying to use logic here. I know it doesn't work, though. I've tried it 1,000 times. So there's nothing left but alcohol at that point. Let's say there's reincarnation. What's the good of it if you don't know it? In other words, I'm sitting here before the microphone, and you're sitting there listening to me on the speaker, right? All right. Let's go down this road together. Let's say you believe in reincarnation. How come you don't know what you were before? What's the good of it then? In other words, let's say you were something else before and you were rewarded or punished and you're now a man again or a woman. You didn't become a bug, let's say, or a louse, a lice, or a Democrat, whatever. You became whatever you are. You didn't. So there you are, right? How come you have no knowledge of what you were before? And since you have no knowledge of what you were before, Who cares if there's reincarnation? That's what I've been thinking about. You mean you know it for a second? You go before like God. I'm not mocking you, God. Don't get mad now. I don't want to be struck dead on the mic. But let's say you go before. All right, like Savage, get up here. All right, let me see. Here's the whole list. All right, read it out to me. And then the angels are, he did this, he did that. You know what he did that time? He did this, he did that, he did that. All right, buddy, we balancing it out. He's not that bad. He missed the mark. He committed some sins, but he's not evil. Evil is another story. Evil are people with Marcy Park type events in their life, not this. All right, overall, you did okay. So here's what we're going to do for you. You're not coming back. The good news is you're not coming back as a roach. All right. You're not coming back as a Democrat. Oh, thank God. You're not coming back working for the Clinton administration. Never. All right. That's thank God I'm not going to be a worm. But the bad news is you're going to come back as a human being again. Oh, God, no. The Buddhist wheel all over again. Do I have to start in the Bronx? Yeah, well, this is what we want to tell you, Mike. Here's the story. There is no time. The whole thing is it's all a racket. There's no time. Clocks have no meaning. Dolly was closer to the truth. They're all bent because the hands move, but nothing else moves. So here's what it is, Mike. You're going to be reborn again in Mount Sinai Hospital in the year you were born to the exact same parents, and you're going to go through the very same life again. No, I don't want that. Why? It was so bad? You want me to make you a bug? No, but do I have to do that all, everything again? The meatball on the wall, the whole thing, the fights in grade school, all over again? Loved by the sewer plant and info in Alley Pond Park? Affirmative action? The radio career? Why, that wasn't good enough for you? Would you like something else? No, God, I'll take it. All right, so that's what I think. I think that in essence, this is it. Whatever you're living now, you're going to live again and again and again forever through eternity. There is no past. There is no present. There is no future. And that's it. So the whole point is, I don't know what it is.
Savage.
My father had a small store. It was actually a stall within a store, an antiques market. They sold everything from junk to reasonably nice things. And he had like three booths put together. And he sold primarily clocks and statues, bronze statues, 19th century French, which I learned to appreciate greatly. And he taught me a lot of things as I was a little kid there. And you could still learn from this. If you go to a museum and you look at sculpture, take a look at some of the statues in the museums and look at the hands and look at the feet. Dad taught me that you can judge an artist in a painting or in a sculpture by the hands and the feet. He said many people can paint the body very well and the face very well, but they can't do hands and feet. And it's always been true. We fabulous piece made out of marble, and you got to look at the hands and feet. It's astounding to see what great art really is. Anyway, so that's it. I grew up in that kind of environment and working in the store. Various people would come in, odd people. You know, in those days, you're talking about a very unusual childhood. And many of the customers happened to be gay. They were decorators, so I was exposed very young to very nice people. And you have to understand, I have no anti-gay bias. I'm just against gay marriage. I want to make that very clear. And my father never had any anti-gay bias. He never said a nasty word. In other words, when the guy left, he was different than the other men. The other men were gruff and they were rough, and these guys were usually well-dressed, and they had a sort of cologne on. And I didn't know that, you know, why they were different in that way. And he never, ever made a disparaging remark about the decorators. I got to tell you, off the map, right off the bat, rather, I was not raised to hate anybody. I got to tell you that. So amongst the variety of humanity that would come through that market, and it would get very busy on a Sunday, mainly on, you know, gapers, onlookers. It was almost like a Coney Island in there because people loved the oddity of it, the strange things that they would find, were many different people. But during the week, I remember once I took off from school, I went in with my father, and a black man came in, which was very unusual in the sense that he didn't have a lot of black customers in those days. I'm talking about the 50s. Man was very well dressed, very thin. I can remember him to this day, and very polite and very quiet and soft-spoken. I didn't know who he was. So the man comes in. My father didn't know him. He didn't know my father. She says to my father, how much is that one? My father says, 300. How much is that one? He says, 500. How much is that one? 800. How much is that clock? 1,200. How much is that one? 900. How much is that one? He went through like 15 pieces. The man quietly didn't chisel him. He said, I'll take them all. Would you please make a note of it and write it? The guy, like, bought 20 pieces or whatever. It was a huge sale. Well, it turned out that this gentleman, this black gentleman, was an antique dealer himself in either North or South Carolina, and he came to New York, you know, to buy and bring it down there to sell, you know, at a higher price. just as my father bought from importers and marked it up to make his living. This fellow went to New York to buy from a retailer who was relatively inexpensive in a poor neighborhood to bring it to his more up-end, higher-end. So to make a long story short and to conclude it, as the gentleman is leaving and he wrote a check, the man leaves. My father says, thank you very much. My father brings me, says, come over here. I want to tell you something. He said, if you learn from this, you'll learn a lesson for the rest of your life. I said, what's that lesson? He said, never, ever judge a man by how he looks. Give every man an equal chance. You just don't know who people are.
Savage.
Let me just tell a 30-second dog story because it's amazing. I said, what could I tell the people that they'd enjoy about the dog? Well, it's just that. I come home. It's the same every night. He gets so crazy. And, you know, dogs are beautiful. I've always had dogs who get excited when they're young. But this one is different. He runs. And you ever see a rabbit run down a pasture? How every number of steps he leaps like with a hop? That's what Teddy does. He has a hop in him. I don't know where the hop came from. He's more rabbit than dog in a way. He runs and then throws himself up with a little hop and tugs at my clothing like in a comic book. And in the beginning, I'd say, Teddy, stop. You're going to rip my clothing. You know what I've come to? I say, Teddy, go ahead, rip my clothing. I don't even care. I let my arms hang down. He can rip my pants. He can rip my... Yeah, he doesn't mean to rip it. He's just trying to say hello. And he keeps going and going and going till he starts to wheeze. I have to stop him, and I have to grab him. I'm afraid the dog's going to, like, stroke out from excitement. But you know what? Why I don't stop him anymore? I'll tell you why. Because I know one day, unless I die from global warming or from a terrorism attack, one day he'll be old, and one day he won't be able to run, and he won't be motivated to run anymore, like my other dog, Snowy. She could hardly move. They become old like we do. They get arthritis, and they become, oh, you're home again? I had a rotten day. Don't even bother me. Look, I'm in the room. That's what they become later on. So I said, if this is what he is now, then enjoy it. Enjoy his joy, because in what, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, whatever it may be, assuming that the earth doesn't melt down because of Al Gore's hot air, the dog won't be able to do it. And what? I'll look back and say, my God, I remember when you were little, Teddy, and you used to run in the driveway until you almost got a stroke and jump and nip at me. Yeah. So you see, you're lucky if you can look forward and see the future, because sometimes it can help you enjoy the present more. And it's the same with the past. If you can look back on the past, it can help you enjoy the present more. People say that you should live here now, be here now. You know, that phrase, be here now, sort of like a hippie thing. Well, they're 100% right, but the best way to be here now is to remember the past and think of the future.
Savage.
Anyway, for whatever the reason, I'm back in my San Francisco studio. I can't wait to get home. Whenever I go away, I don't know what it is. I'm a homebody, you know, like I'm a guy, once you get to know a certain area at a certain point in your life, for better or for worse, it's your home. And when you get to know every corner of the San Francisco Bay, as I know from boating, and I can name every bird on the bay. I don't mean by name. I could mean by species. I can name the birds of the bay. I know the points, Point Blount to wherever you want to name it. I know the coves. I know the names of most of the trees and many of the plants. This is called my home. I am not going to let people drive me out of here. I don't care what they do. I don't care what they say. That is why people fight for their homeland. This is my homeland. And L.A. is really a strange place to me. I got a new suit. I didn't hate it or anything like I did it over Halloween. That was a product of the decadence and the partying, truthfully, which I can't take. It's a great scene in L.A. for a younger person. It's a loud, hysterical, you know, city. But I don't know how anyone could live there after the age of 30. I tell you the truth. I just don't know where they'd have to end up. Certainly you can't live in down, you know, you can't do the scene down there. It's unbelievable. I was in an Italian restaurant Saturday night. All right, the food was fairly good. And it was a change for me from my normal depressing old person San Francisco area Italian restaurant where, you know, that's what it is. I can't eat when people are screaming. They were screaming. And I mean screaming. The decibel level was louder than, let's say, two 1,500 horsepower MTU engines without any covers on them. Without exhausts on them. I never heard anything like it. I don't know how people can eat around it. Screaming, yelling. I can't understand why young people enjoy that kind of scene. And then there was like music behind it on top of it all. But all right, the owner was a friend of my son, and we had a nice time. And, you know, for that regard, I kept going out every 5 minutes with a glass of wine to stand in the street, to stand out on the boulevard and look at the bums and the other people going by. I could hardly eat. But, you know, if you like poseurs, if you like watching the phonies, it's a nice place to watch poseurs. The guy who pulls up, for example, with the Escalade, and he jumps out with a 6'5" bodyguard. And the bodyguard looks as big as a mountain, and he precedes the guy who got out of the car. Now the guy walks into the restaurant, and he looks around. He scans the landscape, doesn't order a drink. Everyone, oh, hello, 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 Bob, hello, you. And he has a single name, like Dodger. Hello, Dodger. Hi, Dodger. Hello, Dodger. Hello, Dodger. And the bodyguard stares at everybody. Then Dodger doesn't buy so much as a glass of wine. Dodger then leaves. Why did he leave? Well, you figure out why. Then Dodger leaves, and I ask a few people, who was that guy with the big bodyguard? He says to me, we don't know, but he's got a lot of money. I said, how do you know he has a lot of money? He says, we heard he has a lot of money. So I inquire a little further of some of the limousine drivers who were there with some of the other young conspicuous consumers. And one said to the other, well, that isn't even his bodyguard. That guy works as a bouncer down the street as a club, and he does this on occasion. So as you start to uncouple the onion, as you start to unfold the onion, you get the picture pretty clearly of the scene. You know, that's it. If you enjoy that kind of thing, God, you know, go and enjoy it. The girls know how to dress. I got to hand it to them, you know, and there's an awful large supply of pointy shoes in Hollywood. That's all I can say. It's the land of the pointy shoe. But these young girls can't get married. Nice-looking girls, they can't get married. Why can't they get married? There's a thousand reasons. What guy is going to marry someone who is, let's say, been on the market, let's put it delicately, for so many number of years? Who wants to marry a party girl from Los Angeles or from Hollywood? No matter how beautiful she is, what is her chance of getting married at age 29 to 30? Very, very low. And so there it is. I mean, you know, I don't know how the guys find anyone. I don't know how the girls find anybody. I don't know who finds anybody anymore.
You're listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
I've expressed exactly what I feel about Obama and his minions. I've told it to you, neo-Marxism. I tell you my fears that we'll be living in a Cuba-like a society within a few years if this man's trajectory is not stopped. In other words, if you let this man win at every turn, this radical professor, this radical street organizer, this Saul Alinsky clone, if you let this man win at every turn within 3 weeks, where would you be in 3 years? Think Castro's Cuba. All of your freedom of speech will be gone. All of your freedom of expression will be gone. You'll be arrested. People will be spying on each other in this country under the guise of peace and love and compassion. That's my deepest fear, is that this man has to be stopped. No man should be a dictator. I don't care whether he's a conservative or a liberal. No president should have absolute power. And you're now living where Big Brother wants to dictate every aspect of your life. Yes, the Democrats rewrote to include illegal alien children, meaning illegal alien children are now going to get a gold-plated health care system, courtesy of you, the moron taxpayer. He got away with it. There was no talk of it in the newspapers. The so-called prophets of our time, the low-life journalists who are cousins to the low-life politicians on the left, did not even let you know that you were just screwed by another Marxist bill. Where is the money going to come from? Doesn't matter. As long as the children have health care, even if they're illegal alien, doesn't matter whether they have the money for it. So as I say, if you don't stop this man, you're going to have a total dictatorship in this country. And we know what the model is. The model is Cuba. That's the model. You don't have to look any further. You don't have to go any more extreme than that. The opposition to Castro disappeared long ago. they were either exiled, self-exiled, left the island, or they were executed, or they were imprisoned for up to 30-some-odd years. Don't say it can't happen here. It will happen here, unless this dictator is shown that he is not a dictator, but he is the president of a republic of the United States of America. Do you understand this? Now, what are the signs of what this man might do if his grandiose schemes are not inhibited? I think that was well put. If his grandiose schemes are not inhibited, what might he do? Well, how about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms? We know that all dictators do not want an armed populace. Not that that means very much anymore, because with the advent of the tax squad and the power of the police, what are you going to do with a gun? Are you going to defend yourself? You'll defend nothing. Look what they did to the poor Randy Weaver at Ruby Ridge. They killed his wife and son, and not one of those criminals in the ATF or the FBI went to jail. They shot Randy Weaver's son in the back with a scoped rifle. That's your government at work. They killed Mrs. Weaver. They shot her. I watched the hearings, and I knew that America died that day. When I saw the most evil woman in the history of American politics, Dianne Feinstein, conduct the Soviet show trial of the trials surrounding the deaths of Randy Weaver's wife and son. They put up a curtain to protect the identity of the murderers, the ATF and FBI agents, who shot Randy's wife and son. And Dianne Feinstein sat there like the Chinese Mandarin she appears to imitate. And I remember to this day how she spoke. "Tell us how it happened, Agent X." "So the calico curtain was blowing in the wind and you could not see clearly when you pulled the trigger, correct?" "Yeah, Dianne." Dianne, if there is a heaven and if there is the other place, I am sure there's a place waiting for you in the other place. That's all I can say. Because we know that you're so powerful right now as chairman of the Senate Armed Intelligence. It's impossible for me to believe that this Harridan, is now the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I've never seen anything like this. Women who have never fired a Daisy BB gun are now in charge of where our troops go. Women who have never fired a Daisy BB gun now read the most intimate intelligence reports and decide what shall and shall not be acted upon. They put our boys in danger, in harm's way. That's where the country is today. So looking ahead, the prognosis to Dr. Savage, for the Dr. Savage, my prognosis for America is very poor. I am sorry to tell you this. I won't say I'm depressed any more than a cancer surgeon would be depressed if he opened up a patient and he saw that the disease had metastasized almost to the point of an irreparable cancer. I do not know what can be used to save this patient. I do not. And for me to say to you there's hope, I would be lying to you. And I'm not going to lie to you, because the day I start lying to you about politics is the day I'll resign. Las Vegas, Amy, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, socialism is such a nasty word to Americans. I can't stand. It's a sensible system, whatever. It's a realistic system. Europeans are clothed, fed, housed.
Hun. Now, I know that in your dear old Europe, the whiskey is supplied by the government, at least the coupons. And I know in Las Vegas there's no shortage of drinks. You can get them for free in any casino. But before you call the show again to talk about the wonders of socialism, will you please go to your AA meeting or take Antabuse? Thank you. 1-800-449-825. What did I need a Lush for on this show? For God's sakes.
I love the socialism. Your socialism is good. You know, you go over there, it looks so happy in Europe. It's a happy place in Europe. They're all happy in Europe.
Yep, they're all happy in Europe. That's until you talk to the average Italian. Ask him what he thinks about his country being invaded by the illegal immigrants who are robbing and raping their way across their country like locusts. Ask them how happy they are in Norway about the rapes and the robberies being committed by the illegal aliens. The stuff that you don't read in the socialist-owned newspapers. Ask the average person in Europe how they love their country. Ask the average Spaniard how he feels about the subway bombings. Ask the average Londoner how he feels about his country being invaded. Ask the average Englishman how he feels about his country being overrun by illegal aliens who have now spawned so many children that they're minorities in their own country. Ask the couple in England how they feel about a socialist government, in Scotland rather, that just took away two children from grandparents in their 50s and gave them to a homosexual couple. Ask them how much they love socialism.
Will you please?
Savage.
It's easy to write this stuff and sound smart, like in the old days, sitting around under an olive tree, walking around old Jerusalem. You know, there shall be no mischief befall the righteous, but the wicked are filled with evil. All right, take a walk. Throw them out of the cafe. Troublemaker looking for free coffee. A wise son is instructed of his father, but a scorner heareth not rebuke. Get out. Take a walk, you old bum. You know, how much can you believe? You think I believe in all of this, every word of it? How can you? Basically written by old men under olive trees looking to make a buck. They were the journalists of their time. Proverbs were written by unemployed journalists. There were no newspapers then, so they walk around writing Proverbs. You know what I'm saying? They figured to someone, ooh, look what he said, a rebellious man seeketh only evil. Therefore a cruel messenger shall be sent against him. All right, let's hear a little bit more. Here's a shekel. Speak more. Speak, sage. Tell us more Proverbs. Whoso rewardeth evil for good, evil shall not depart from his house. Whoa, here's another shekel. Hey, man, look at this guy. Come around this guy. He's good. He's on a roll. Throw him a couple of shekels there. You want a lox? What do you want? A fish? All right, let's hear another one. A merry heart is good medicine, but a broken spirit drieth the bones. Whoa, throw him the shekels. Today they'd be working for Gannett newspapers. This is history repeating itself. There are theories as to why the Aztec people were wiped out, one of which is as a result of infections brought in by European conquistadors. It seems to me that this is history being repeated sort of in reverse, where those conquered by the conquistadores are now going to infect us and wipe us out. The people know this intuitively, which is why the states are trying to do what the pimps in the federal government won't do. And I use that phrase not for shock value, but because there's no other word for a federal government that continues to abuse the American people in such a dramatic manner. They are overrunning us. They are destroying our schools like locusts. They're destroying our hospitals. They're bringing in diseases. 30% of all prisoners are illegal aliens, which is a fact that's conveniently forgotten in any discussion. They're killing us. Now, we know that many of them worked very hard. We understand that. But the price we're paying is awesome, overwhelming. And for a federal government to permit staphylococcus, tuberculosis, and other diseases to be brought into a country is a mark of criminality. There's no other word for it, but I'm not shocked. It's the same federal government that wants to sell sensitive technology to the communist Chinese government for a dollar. That's another. I mean, it's interrelated. When you have no conscience and no one minding the store, what you wind up with is a president with the lowest ratings in history, separated from the people only by a police force and a military. The people hate them. The people have no respect for any of them, nor any respect for any of the would-be presidents, because they know they're all part and parcel of the same puzzle. And where does it end? When you see people who have children and grandchildren who do not care about the ramifications of raping the Treasury, what are we the people supposed to do? Here's a story that's so hand in glove with what I'm telling you. A Mexican national infected with a highly contagious form of tuberculosis crossed the U.S. border 76 times and took multiple domestic flights in the last year, according to Customs and Border Protection interviews and documents, obtained by the Washington Times. There's your government at work. 76 times. And the Customs and Border Protection Agency was warned by health officials on April 16th that this frequent traveler from Mexico was infected with this TB, but it took the morons at Homeland Security 7 weeks to issue a May 31 alert to warn its own border inspectors, according to Homeland Security sources who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution from Pinhead, who runs the Homeland Security Department. There it is. There it is. They're covering up the invasion of this country. They're covering up the infection of this country. They're covering up the selling out of our national security of this country. And we know it. But it gets worse. It gets worse. So now you're going to expect the government to stop a Mexican with a highly contagious form of TB? You think they're going to stop him? Why would the pinhead who runs Homeland Security do anything to protect this country? It's a bureaucracy. It's about trillions of dollars and nothing more to these people. Can you believe that this would happen to our country, that the people have no faith in either party? I've never seen it like this. I have never seen it like this. I wake up, and each day it gets worse than the day before, much worse than the day before. Houston, Texas. Jason, go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, as a student of history, I'm glad that you mentioned the Spanish conquest of the Americas, because I frankly don't see any difference between the illegal invasion of the Spaniards, who infected millions and millions of Native Americans with, at that time, an incurable disease of smallpox. Yeah,
but the only difference was the Aztecs fought back, whereas we have been homosexualized and feminized and put into a sort of prison of fear where none of us are able to fight back without fearing for our very lives or being imprisoned for committing some kind of crime for speaking the truth.
Granted, but don't you think that it's somewhat related to your ethnobiology, that these same people that were conquered, and raped as a people, that they received some of this Spaniard blood to illegally perform acts of crime and heresy onto the United States of America?
Well, you're giving me a leading question. I'm not going to be baited into that response. I wouldn't talk about blood. I would simply talk about greed. And it's the greed of our overlords more than it is about blood. The overlords want the cheap labor. The Democrats want the cheap vote. And therefore, we have this invasion. So I thank you very much for that call. 1-800-449-8255. 1-800-449-8255. You got to go onto michaelsavage.com and check out these stories. You must go on to my website and read. But they it's a lead that goes nowhere. It hits a cul-de-sac. Normally, in my day, in other words, if they wrote about a disease, the reporter, the journalist, they call them journalists. Today they call them, in those days it was a reporter. Then they give themselves a fancy name. The stupider they became, the more brainwashed the profession became, the fancier the name. Those old-time reporters with a pencil in their hand were 50 times smarter than these schmucks with their whiz kid geniuses. So you start a report about an infection spreading throughout a country. Logically, the people would read the article and want to know why. There is no why. They tell you to wash your hands. Can you believe this? These are the same schmucks who, when the AIDS epidemic was spreading, like the epidemic it was, they told you to wear a condom. They wouldn't tell you why the AIDS epidemic was spreading, who was spreading it, what subpopulations were getting it. They panicked everybody and made you tell you to put a condom on. And so we have the same kind of mentality here with the staph infection, you see.
Savage.
Hot-headed men who explode with anger seem to be at greater risk of having a stroke or dying, new research shows. Their risk is even greater than men who are simply stressed-out type A personalities. But here's the funny part of it. If you're a hot-headed man, you can get a stroke, according to these morons who did the study. But if you're an angry woman, listen to this. Angry women, on the other hand, don't run as high a risk of having a stroke. What is the point of this stupid retrospective epidemiological study? Again, from the Framingham study. Over and over, the Framingham. These guys have gone through that data. For 40 years, people have made livings on this garbage. Framingham, Massachusetts, they did one study. Over and over again, they go back and they look at the data. They try to cull it for yet another grant, you know. And here's what they figured out, these schmucks. Hot-headed men who explode with anger seem to be a greater risk of having a stroke or dying, but not women. Next, they'll tell us in a new study of the Framingham study, again, it's from Massachusetts, they have found that hot-headed men who are Republicans seem to be of having a greater risk of having a stroke or dying than do Democratic women. Oh, yeah, it's lucky I was born with a natural sense of impossibility. And here's what this study's author said. While we're confident it's accurate, it's not appropriate to say it's definitive. And you wonder why I left science or why science left me. Science today is all politics, number one. There's almost no science left. Yes, there's technology and there's applied research, but there's no basic science left in America. While we're confident it's accurate, it's not appropriate to say it's definitive. A comedian in the Catskills couldn't get away with that. Dr. John Osborne, a cardiologist at Baylor University in Grapevine, who was not... Do you really believe this? That you can get a stroke if you lose control? Oh, don't call me on this, please. Let me rip it up. I don't want to talk about strokes. What do you think, I'm Billy Crystal?
Savage.
Normally during a show, I have TVs on and I'm watching the cable channels to see what the moron, like, Brett Hume. There's Brett Hume. Hi, I'm Brett Hume. What is that? I'm a Brett Hume. How are you? I'm a Brett Hume. How are you, Brett? That guy looks like he sleeps in a tie and suit. Like droopy eyes. Hi, I'm Brett Hume. How are you? Hi, Brett. What do you do? I'm a Brett Hume. Yes, I'm Brett Hume. How are you? Are you Brett Hume? Yes, I'm Brett Hume. I'm a Brett Hume. I used to work for the president. I'm Brett Hume. I'm Brett Hume. I'm Brett Hume. The president respects me. Brett Hume. So I don't even watch it anymore. What I have on now is like the Weather Channel. A, the babes I like because like they wear bad outfits, which is funny to see. Like the Weather Channel girls are really funny. They're like ordinary good-looking women. And some of them are like cute faces. They look like cute, you know, like a girl next door. They're not particularly beautiful. Because nobody would take that job if they're looking to become an actress. This is like the last, this is where as far as they're going to go. The guys wear like suits from, leftover suits from Tonga. I mean, these were suits that were remained from like Macy's 3 years ago. They were sent to Tonga and Fiji and Tahiti. They didn't even sell there. And then they get sent back in remnant merchandise to like green rooms of the Weather Channels around the world, like in Syria. And that's the kind of suits these guys wear. You know, like they're behind with the flap in the back. You could see it's like one size too small. They don't know to wear a little oversized on TV. Otherwise, they make even a good-looking guy look like he's out of shape. But the girls are saying they wear like bad pants suits from 1970. It's almost like disco-era outfits that they wear. And the jewelry is from QVC. Like, again, recycled. They went from QVC. It went from like Macy's to QVC and a remnant. Then they couldn't even sell it on QVC. They sold it to Tonga, Fiji, Samoa, the Marquesas, and the natives looked at it and rejected it. They didn't even want the trinkets. So some guy came down there from Brooklyn. He was like praying, all right, I'll buy it all. Give me the whole lot for $12, $12.50 in a seashell. He buys it back from them in the islands, and now he sells it to the Weather Channel for the girls to wear.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I guess the best news of the day is that my local funny paper, the Chronicle, will be sold off to the lowest bidder, because if no one bids for it, Hearst is finally going to throw in the towel. I'm going to make an offer right now on the radio show, because I think it'll be fun to hire those people at the Chronicle who have pretended I don't exist. Now, all these years I've been here in the Bay Area, my show was the biggest hit that ever hit radio. I went national. No one else ever did and succeeded. I have a huge audience, bestsellers. And they pretend they don't exist. What they don't know is that prior to the radical left taking over the paper, I was actually quite popular with the newspaper writers in the 70s before this band of losers took over the newspaper. So I'm going to make an offer right now for the Chronicle. I hope that the Hearst people are listening to the show. And I'm going to now appeal directly to the managers of the Chronicle who are looking for a buyer. And apparently their names are Benick and Schwartz. They said survival is the outcome we all want to achieve. But without specific changes, we're going to, across the entire Chronicle organization, we'll have no choice but to quickly seek a buyer for the Chronicle. And should a buyer not be found, to shut down the newspaper. Now, I do not want to see the local newspaper shut down. I'd like to see it become a newspaper again. And I'm pretty sure there's going to be no buyers for it, but I'm willing to offer right now $100 for the San Francisco Chronicle. Do I hear 101? Why you want 101? I got 101. No, really. Frank A. Bennett Jr., Hearst Vice Chairman and Chief Executive, and Stephen R. Swartz. How do you have a name Swartz? I mean, where I came from with S-C-H, now it's... it's Swartz, S-W-A-R-T-Z. That's like hiding the C-H, I think. But anyway, President of Hearst Newspaper said in a joint statement that they're going to take the highest bidder or close it down. So Michael Savage now on his national radio show with 8 to 10 million listeners a week is offering $100 to purchase the San Francisco Chronicle, but I will not purchase the debt with it. I'm going to make that very clear. The Chronicle lost more than $50 million in 2008. God, and is on a pace to lose more than that this year. That's about $1 million a week. I wonder why they're losing $1 million a week. Could it be because they hate families? That is real families as opposed to the fraudulent variety. Let's see. They hate the family. They hate the police. They hate the military. They hate the church, particularly the Mormon church. They hate conservatives. They hate borders. They hate language. They hate culture. They appeal only to you-know-who and also to the illegal alien. Now, since there are only a few in the you-know-who category, and illegal aliens don't buy English language newspapers, now you kind of understand the formula for disaster. And that's why I say I will buy the Chronicle, and I'm making a firm offer of $100 right now for this newspaper right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Now here's a true childhood story that I may have told once in 15 years of radio. Barry Schmaltz and his crazy mother Betty Schmaltz and his father Louis Schmaltz. The names have been changed to protect the Schmaltzes. Let's see. How do I begin the story? He was about 15 years old. He was a tall kid. His bedroom, pink carpet, two-story house, nice house. He's having a fist fight with his father in the bedroom over something his mother said. It ends with him crying and enraged because he knew he could beat the heck out of his father after a few real good punches were thrown. I don't know if you've ever seen a father and son fight. It's actually heartbreaking to see. To me, it was a violation of a very deeply held taboo. Never to strike your father, no matter what. Well, I don't know, but that family was crazy from top to bottom. They went at each other with straight rights and blasted each other. And it ended with the kid holding his punches because I think he could have really knocked his father on his butt. He picked up a piggy bank that to me was like, looked like a 25-pound piggy bank that he had, a ceramic one, since I knew him for 10 years. And he was enraged and red-faced and tears running down his eyes. He looked at his father, and he smashed the piggy bank on the floor, and all the coins that he had collected since childhood was smashed. And then the father threw him out of the house, and he wound up living in my mother's in our basement for a little while. Now, I don't know this guy anymore, but let me tell you what happened that day. Here's what happened that day. His mother was a would-be, like, movie star. As many women were in the 50s, they were always trying to be, like, either not Marilyn Monroe, but there were some buxom movie, like Jane Mansfield, more like that type. Cadillac, the platinum blonde hair, always showing off. The father was a worker, gray-faced. He'd come home gray-faced from his job. He owned a little wholesale milk business. So they were a little better off than us somehow. But she had the Cadillac, the Coupe de Ville, pink one. And a whack job, nuts, out of her mind. Why? She was always trying to lose weight. She went to some doctor in New Jersey who put her on Benzedrine or some kind of amphetamines, which gave her a madness, a Benny high. And so she comes home crazy out of her mind, and she takes a dog chain. And she a dog chain, and beats her wrist till it bleeds just before the father comes in at dusk, ashen-faced from the day in the milk plant. And she says, Louie, look what your rotten son did to me. Look what he did to my hands. Well, Louie, the father, naturally would be protective of his wife. He runs upstairs and screams to the kid, Barry, what did you do to your mother? And the kid says, I didn't do anything. You liar, you. And that's when they fought. And that's when it happened. That's when the piggy bank. So from the crazy mother, Betty Schmaltz, who turned Louis against Barry. Now, you say drug usage is prevalent today. Let me tell you something. There's plenty of drug usage in those glorious Eisenhower days. But it was sub rosa drug usage. Half the women were either on Milltown or on Benzedrine for diet. Milltown was as popularly prescribed then as Prozac, let's say, is today. You know, a lot of kids came home from college and used a little Milltown with rosé wine, Meduse rosé. They got a nice buzzeroo during the afternoons when the mother wasn't home. So I'm telling you, that's the schmaltz story. It's a sad story. And the kid wound up basically a bug all his life. He was never stable. Well, I haven't seen him in many years. Right? He was a good friend of mine, but he's not a reliable friend because when a kid can't rely upon his mother or his father, he winds up to be an unreliable person in life 99% of the time. He winds up to be someone you can't count on because he can never count on somebody else.
Savage.
I took a little time after the show, and then I went up to North Beach in San Francisco, where I go very often. And I figured, you know what, I'm not in the mood for a big meal at all. I'm going to stop into my friend's restaurant, the North Beach restaurant, and I'm going to have one scotch because I felt a sore throat coming on. I'll have one drink. So I walk in and I go to the bar. There's Lorenzo, my friend Petroni, the owner, blah, blah, blah. So I order I think it was a Glenfiddich, 12-year-old, and I get a drink. And we start to, you know, talk and have a good time. He and I really like each other. We've known each other 20 years. One word leads to the other. Naturally, after a drink, I'm already in another mood. And talking to a guy I know, I'm already in another mood. And the restaurant's a nice place to be. So I said, you know what? I think I'm going to stay for dinner. So I said, tell the kid outside, I'm going to keep the car out there. I'm going to stay. So we sit down. I sit at the owner's table. And I don't know if you know what it's like to eat in a restaurant when you're eating with the owner. But it's a pretty amazing experience, particularly as a guy like him. So he said, well, what do you want to eat? I said, no, let's start with a salad. What do I know? So what do you want to drink? Right away, the wine and this. And I don't want to drink any wine after scotch. And I'm insisting, I can't mix the grape and the grain. He says, no, you got to have my wine. You got to have my wine. I said, I cannot go from the grain to the grape. Give me a beer. Give me a Budweiser. That's all I want. So he's drinking his wines. We're eating the salad. He said, well, what do you want now? What do you want now? I said, what do you have now? I said, do you have any chicken feet? So he says, let me tell you about chicken. He says, on my farm, he raises all of his grapes. He raises olives up there for his own olive oil. I went up there when he first did it. I remember when he cleared the land. I'm talking 15 years ago. I went up there in the old caddy, and it was before he cleared the hillsides in Sonoma. Now he's got olives and olive oil and a vineyard. So I've watched this develop. So to make a long story short, he says, well, I got chickens too. I got 70 chickens. I said, well, get me some chicken feet. So he starts to laugh. He says, oh, I got to tell you about my rooster. I said, well, what about your rooster? He says, I gave the rooster three chances to make the chickens have eggs. Three times, he said, the rooster couldn't do it. He says, I broke his neck. He says, I cooked the rooster. So at this point, we're having a great time and this and that. And then what do you want to eat? He says, you want tripe? I said, I don't want tripe. What's tripe? It's intestines? Yes. So he says, all right, I don't want any cow's intestine. I said, my mother used to make it and stuff it. He says, no, Italian style's not stuffed. I said, okay, I don't want it anyway. Let's forget about it. You want osso buco? I said, all right, give me osso buco. Osso buco. One course after another. So we're eating like it's in Italy, and we're talking about sons and daughters and wives, about the past, about the present, about the future. In other words, we're having a good time. And in comes another gentleman who is a television station owner. And so we have this gentleman who's an Irish guy. And well, now we start sitting down. The drinks are increasing in number. And we turn to Hard Childhoods because the name Obama came up. And this gentleman says, although I'm a conservative, we should give Obama a chance. And I said, come on, we gave him a chance. We gave him a chance. We see what the guy's going to do. And we're arguing and this and that, but in a friendly way. So they start talking about how tough their childhoods were. Now we're talking about our childhoods. And to show you what a tough childhood can do, each of the men at that table, myself included, are quite successful. But none of us were given a silver spoon. None of us were given a government handout. So the gentleman, the TV executive, says, let me give you an idea. I come from a family of 8 children. There were so many of us. My father didn't know our names. He said, but I know this, that when we came home with our report cards, he'd take each of us individually behind the door, and we'd hear the strap come out and the belt job. And he says, you, get in here. He didn't even know my name. But if the grades weren't good enough, that was the upbringing I had. So we're laughing. Then Lorenzo says, you think that was a tough childhood? He said, try mine. On our farm in Italy, when I was a little boy, it was occupied by the Nazis. They took over our farmhouse, my grandmother, my grandfather, my mother, and I. We were put into the barn. We had to live in the barn while the Nazis lived in our house. And yet, you look at these guys. They came over here with nothing. They started with nothing. And look where they are today, and myself included. And we're talking and having a good time. I don't know what course I was up to at that point or what beer I was up to at that point. Now, you got to understand, and you got to picture this. I'm sitting behind an alcove near the opening, the beginning of the North Beach restaurant, right at the front there behind the alcove, like the owner's table. I see the two guys I'm sitting with look over to the entranceway, and they say, ah, there's the man we were just talking about, the mayor. So I thought they were referring to the former mayor, Mayor Brown. Lo and behold, it's my good friend, Eni Toosom Newsom, who I rail against pretty regularly. So he doesn't know I'm there. He comes around the corner and he jumps back. He's, oh, my God. I said, here's your nemesis sitting here, Gavin. So I said, look, Gavin, let me tell you something. I hate your politics, but I like you as a person. You're a nice guy. Why are you so left of center? So he sits down and he has a beer and we're talking. And, you know, there's a story within the story. The story within the story is that even though people may be 180 degrees off from you politically, you got to remember their humanity or else we will descend into chaos. Now, I recognize that because I'm a full human being, and I'm sure the mayor of the city recognizes that because he's a full human being. But I don't think Senator Tom Harkin recognizes that. I don't think that some of these senators who want to destroy conservative talk radio are full human beings. I think that they are ghouls. Anyway, that's my story. Let's have the Tarantala. This is the Savage Nation. Take your calls at 1-800-449-8255. Remember what I do here. I do a news, views, and a reviews. And if I got to tell the world through a rooster, I'll do it. If I got to tell you the world... Hey, wait a minute. Stop the music. It just dawned on me. I know why I'm playing the Tarantala. I couldn't remember. I said to Lorenzo last night, and the other gentleman, did you ever hear my poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti? He said, no. I said, no, I've been playing it for 15 years on the show. I said, you're Italian. How could you not hear it? He said, no, I never heard it. So he said, well, what is it like? What's the poem like? I couldn't remember my own poem. So, gentlemen, if you can get up the poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti, get it up in the sound archive. Tell me when it's up. Is it ready now? You're searching? You're searching the digital archive? Okay, wait. Don't play it. So I said, I don't know, but the gist of my poem is this. And I remember now, I'm sitting in a fancy Italian restaurant. I said, the gist of the poem is that when I was a kid, spaghetti was 50 cents a plate in a cheap Italian restaurant. I said, and they called it spaghetti. I said, now that they call it pasta, it's $15.99. Well, they broke into another laugh. Play the poem. The hairy forearms of New York serve you your coffee with a turning gesture, an offering that says drink, eat, enjoy. The wiry Italian in Vincent's clam bar, the one behind the greased over register, the young kid connected who receives his deference from the spaghetti cook older than his gangster father, the spaghetti cook who looks like an old-fashioned doctor from the Bronx with clipped mustache. He actually pulls some noodles out of the pot and eats them as they cook, looking to the grimy ceiling for his tender answer. Well, they used to call it spaghetti. Now it's pasta at $10 a plate. The smoky windows of Romeo's Spaghetti now offers radios and knickknacks. It was 50 cents a plate then, in neon letters that you couldn't miss, even through a fogged-over window on a cold winter's eve. There was life. Marinara sauce that smacked to the sea. Noodles as long as your young arm. Meatballs as fluffy as your dream of them. Bread on the table you'd eat against your parents' admonitions that the meal was coming, the meal was coming. And men, some burly with black hairy forearms whose smiles scared you, and little skinny guys with the look of murder on their faces, and people who slurped their spaghetti straight to their mouths from the plate, one motion like Chinese shoveling rice at mouth with clicking sticks. That was gusto before it became a beer ad. That was taste before it became a synonym for fashion. That was spaghetti before it became pasta.
You're listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
I'm eating grapes and I'm drinking a herbal tea right now. You'll have to forgive me. I have a sore throat. I'm doing what I want. God, that's a good thing. And I am spraying. I have a spray for my throat. It's worked pretty well. Let's see what works this week. Echinacea Golden Seal Propolis Throat Spray. An herbal spray. Wow. I've used this for years. And every time I feel this sore throat coming on, this stuff has stopped it. Along with scotch at night. I actually use it without scotch and it works good. But an old man I know who doesn't even drink told me 2-3 years ago, he doesn't drink. He's 80-something. He said every time he felt the sore throat coming on, he said, get a really good scotch and basically, you know, gargle with it. And you'll stop the bacteria that is that are trying to proliferate. It's amazing. Other alcohol doesn't do it for me. When I was a kid, I would use my father taught me the old Russian trick of salt water, you know, warm salt water. Ugh, horrible. It's like a shipwreck. I mean, if you have a sore throat and you're trying to stop it, I mean, the scotch is a better idea than salt water. It feels like Survivor Man. That's a weird show, Survivor Man, isn't it? There's one thing I can't understand. If he's left on these places like a week, and how does he get the camera equipment in there? Well, what's a Survivor Man? Who's taking the pictures of him? He's suffocating in a raft. He's dying in the snow. I mean, what is he kidding? You know, the camera's running. I don't get that show. It's kind of, after a while, you don't know what to make. Nothing's real anymore. Survivor Man. Some Survivor Man, you know. Nanook of the North was Survivor Man. He was the original Survivor Man, Nanook of the North. The Plains Indian was the Survivor Man. The Plains Indian who learned how to live off the land without electricity and without the government, sending him government cheese and providing him with HUD money. I mean, that was Survivor Man. How did the Native Americans survive for 10,000 years in North America without the government, without cheese, government cheese and such? How did they do it? How? How did your ancestors do it? How'd they come over here with the guts they had? How'd they do it? How'd they do it? It's a nation of whipped cream. America, the nation of whipped cream. Lincoln and Washington. It may as well be Lindsay Lohan Day and Paris Hilton Day for the average American. You know, I got to get rid of AOL as a website. I have AOL for email. I can't take it anymore. I'm going to change my email address. Every time I start it up, it's something about one of these dumb skirts and what they've done in Hollywood or some degenerate in Hollywood. What are they doing? What is the average kid on email 6 years old? Well, every time I go in, I get assaulted. It's like worse than a supermarket AOL. In a supermarket, I try not to look at like the National Enquirer as I check out with food. Every time I go on to AOL for my email, I got to look at something about a skirt in Hollywood and her girlfriend. You know, did she like her girlfriend? And did someone like his boyfriend? Who did this in Hollywood? I don't know. I hope they go out of business, frankly, right now. What are they doing this for? Everyone's 4 years old? Someone once said this to me, a professor back in 1970. He said, you know, you're the only person I've ever met. He said, it's astonishing that you can function. He says, you have no barrier between your conscious and your subconscious. You actually function with both at once. So I said, and? So? What's wrong with that? In other words, I've plumbed my depth sufficiently through self-analysis to know who I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. What do I got to hide? I'm not like most people. I mean, well, what's there to hide? When everything I see isn't so pretty. But that's life, you know? Out of the muck, a lotus will grow. We all come from the muck, and we all go back to the muck. We come from the muck. We go back to the muck. What more do you need to know? None of us are demigods. None of us are God. Once you understand that we arise from a smelly ether called the swamp of life, and that is what we go back to, the rest is very easy. Then you stop worrying about if you have an extra little flab on your stomach and a gray hair and a mole on your face, and you suddenly accept yourself for what you are. Then you can wear an undershirt and look at yourself in the mirror and say, that's it, thank God I'm alive, and I got two legs and two arms and two lungs and a beating heart. What more do I need? I'm going to look like a bicycle rider who takes cocaine? Oh, God, what am I talking about? Why are you listening to me? I'm going up and down the scale here. I'm playing the scales for you on the Savage Nation. No, I'm a little upset because I opened a letter just now, a personal letter. I shouldn't have done it during the show. I got all my mail, and I opened one from a relative. It's a shocker. It's a picture of my late father from a year before he died. Photo of daddy in clothes. Kept it in the, your mother kept it in her bag till she did. No, I never saw this picture. He looked healthy. He shouldn't have died this young. I'm older than he was, and he died. It's eerie. Yeah, I thank God Oscar the cat is in here. He's liable to curl up next to me, and it will be all be all over. He's in better shape than I am. Are you kidding me? And he died anyway? Not a gray hair on his head. And thin? I put on weight. I got gray hair, and I'm still kicking. Go figure it out. You know how many guys died in their 30s that I knew who were runners? Huffing and puffing with watches, and they'd vitamin him, and every minute they looked at their watch. They wouldn't touch this, and they ate perfect. They dropped dead like flies. I don't say don't exercise, but no man is made to run like an Ethiopian bee picker day and night. You're not living in Ethiopia at 12,000 feet. That's why they win these races everywhere. That's they run at high altitudes. You don't. Every year there's a few blowouts here with the San Francisco, what do they call it? Marathon, the marathon. Every year they got someone dropping dead before the finish line. If you want to run, go run. Enjoy yourself. This too shall pass. This, I have a whole different theory of exercise at a certain point in your life. Now, remember, I wrote the book on nutrition, and I also exercise moderately, but the key word is moderately. This excessive, like you're on a treadmill, heart attackville. It's worse than sitting in front of a television and eating Doritos. And I'm telling you, no human being is made to... You ever see old men running like that? It's insanity, total insanity. Show me in nature where a man runs like that after the age of 40, unless he's being chased by a predator who wants to burn his house down. Nobody runs like that if they don't have to. What did the great American writer say? Mark Twain, he said, I get all my exercise going to the funerals of my more athletic friends. It was funny. It worked for him. The guy was, for him, it worked. I'm sure if he ran, he would have been dead at 30. I'll never forget when I stopped running the day. Are you interested in any of this? Or do you want to talk about home invasion? I'm in a sweat from the whole story already. I ate nuts during the break. I got this picture. Now I'm having palpitations. I think I'll have a pizza for dinner tonight and beer. Nah, I think tonight I'm going to drive into the city. I'm not in the city. I'm not in San Francisco now. I'm out in the suburban location, one of my Arafatian houses. I have many locations. I don't know where I'm going to be the next night. That way, if anyone, they don't know where I'm going to, because I don't know where I'm going to broadcast from or where I'm going to sleep. I have several locations. I have to. That's what the liberals are today. I have to watch out for them because they're all psychopaths. Every last one of them belongs in a mental hospital. Or in a straitjacket. That's all. Forget it. I don't want to go into bashing liberals. It's been done too often. And I did it better than anybody else. Oh, let's move on. Sunni Shiites, not interested. I don't ever want to know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite. I'm not interested. I don't care about them. They're obsessed with themselves. And the media, who never told you once what Judaism was or what Christianity was, except once a year around Christmas, now they're an expert. Every day they give you an expert story on Islam. The same liberals. Isn't it interesting how they love Islam? They can't get enough of it. They're experts in the Sunni sect, the Shia sect. Now, you see, when you talk and talk. And he looked good. Look at this. I can't get it out of my head. I shouldn't have looked at these pictures. He was, God bless him. A lot of good it did him, the wife. Black hair, thin, kept in shape, and dead. And what about Winston Churchill? He sat in the bathtub drinking brandy and smoking cigars. It hurt him? Could you picture him running around, let's say, England during World War II, saying, I got to do a stress break now? Our president, all our NBA-like leaders, they all run, they're in perfect shape, and they can't think. He sat with a brandy and a cigar in a bathtub. He was able to lead Britain through the darkest days of World War II. How is that? How is that possible? You know, maybe variety, have a drink and sit in a bathtub with a cigar. Maybe you could save the country. You'll have some insights. Like, take the handcuffs off the men, number one, and tell the liberals to go to hell, number two. That might save America. KNEW, San Fran. What? Someone from England sent me a new one. I use San Francisco, San Francisco. San Fran. She called us something else, a friend from somewhere, a long email. San Fran. I can't remember why I bring it up. Savage. 9:10, I slipped into a little Italian restaurant in the suburbs. I like to go as late as I can when the kids are home. I can't eat around coloring books. I don't know what it is. If I see a Crayola, I leave the restaurant. That's the warning sign, is a Crayola, because I know what's coming, a lecture and how bright the child is. They always ask for lessons on the constant. I never heard anything like it. They're like schools. It's like Dr. Spock in a restaurant. I can't eat around it. So God bless children. I mean, I raised some, but we didn't bring coloring books and a Crayola to the I get there 10 to 9, and I see that they're closing up, and I look around at the workers. You know, they're 99% Hispanic people, hard-working people. And you get a new appreciation for reality. Now, who's doing? Who's cooking the food? Who's cleaning the floor? Who's serving the tables? You know what I'm saying? So, like, I'm not blind to reality. God bless them. They're good people. They work hard jobs. We're talking about getting rid of the deadbeat bums on welfare and the criminals. Let's, you know, let's split the pot in half here. You clean out the 30% of illegal aliens who constitute our prison population. You get rid of the bums on welfare. You cut off free medical care, and I'll tell you what, then you can give everybody else a citizenship as far as I'm concerned, because no one else wants the job. So as I'm saying, I ordered dinner, and I was antsy already. I waited very late to eat, and the roads were beautiful. They were empty. I love to drive on a road when they're empty. You know, that lit up, those lit up things in the middle that they like flit by. Everything was like perfect. I didn't have a drink or anything. I don't think I'm like I was high on it. Nothing. But just the empty road after Thanksgiving, the highway markers were lit up. It was like a runway. It was gorgeous. It's like driving on the tarmac rather than Highway 101 over the Golden Gate Bridge. So I pull off the road. I pull in. I go in. And I order a very simple dinner. Please give me the salad. Which one? Blah, blah, blah. I said, just no gorgonzola cheese, please. I don't even know what gorgonzola cheese is, but it smells like dog vomit, okay? I don't know why anyone would eat it. That's something only a Frenchman could enjoy. So I got that, and then I said, could you please make me well-cooked spaghetti, shrimp calamari, marinara sauce, no salt and pepper? Now, that's a very complicated order, by the way, for an average, you know, kind of run-of-the-mill restaurant. Because if you don't say no salt and pepper, your skin itches and you have high blood pressure from one meal. And she brings it out. It's perfect. Then I had two beers. I'm going to lay it out for a reason for you. The bill was $27. I gave her $40. I said, keep the change. She said, oh, thank you, senor, blah, blah, blah. I'm a very big tipper, by the way, particularly when people are nice. I gave her 50% of the bill. So she opens up to me like out of nowhere. And she says to me, oh, she says, I said, I'm surprised you're closing so early. She said, well, we used to be open till 10, senor. Now we close at 9. I said, why, business is down? Oh, she's very, very bad. I said, what do you mean it's down? She said, I used to make almost all my money, she said, in the 9 to 10 o'clock hour. She said, but now we're closed then because the people aren't coming. I said, oh, you mean the older people come between 9 and 10 after the Crayola crowd leaves. When the Ritalin crowd leaves, in come the real, you know, the people who want a peaceful meal. She didn't quite get it, but I'm a cynical guy, you know. So she said, yes, the older people come in. And she said, I used to, in my shift alone, she said I would take in between $800 and $1,200. Not in tips now. You're talking about gross, what she'd sell. And so you figured the tips on 20%, she was making herself $200, $250 a night on that, right? She says, now my gross is $300. I can't live on $50 a night. She says, I have three little ones at home. I said, it's terrible. I said, the economy is really hitting people. I mean, you know, you look at it from the point of view of a hardworking woman, immigrant woman, three babies, probably single mother. It's hitting her. People are not, you know, going out like they used to go out. So you say, well, where do you know where it's happening? You know what's happening there. You see the Chevy dealerships are gone. They're closing down. The way the police used to close down illicit bordellos in New York, they're closing down auto dealerships in America today. For different reasons, of course, but I'm making a gross comparison in two ways. And so if you are a waiter or a waitress or a taxi driver, other than Robert De Niro is putting out one stink bomb after another for the money, I don't blame him either. If you're foolish enough to go watch Al Pacino with false teeth, you know, and Ralph, whatever, De Niro's brother-in-law, Ralph De Niro, whatever, is Ralph, what's his name? Ralph something or other? Hey, Ralphie. Ralph De Niro, whatever. I don't remember their names anymore. It's a blur. If you want to go watch them, good luck to you. But the point I'm making is that if you're a taxi driver or a waiter or a waitress, I'd like you to call the show at 1-800-449-8255 and tell the people actually how you're being affected by the downturn in the economy, because you actually know what's going on. Although the crooks and the charlatans at the top pretend they care, they're just robbing you blind. That's all. And as it used to be said, all roads lead to Rome. Now, why was that saying all roads lead to Rome? Because the Romans were the greatest road builders of their time. Some of their roads still exist. And, of course, you have to change that today, which is that all roads lead to Nancy Pelosi.
Savage.
I'm thinking, you know, America needs a life raft right now because we all fear the ship of state could go down. But what is that life raft? The reason my mind is on life rafts is because I just got one for my boat. You know, I've owned a 45-foot overall powerboat for 5 years. I've got many, many hundreds of hours on powerboats. I'm not a sailor. I have had sailboats, but I'm a powerboat guy. They're more convenient, and you can, you know, go where you want to go when you want to go. It's just a choice. That's all there is to it. So I have this boat, and I've had only a small, like, 50-pound, you know, raft you could throw overboard that'll hold only two people. And I always say to myself, what, are you crazy? Why don't you have, you know, something, you know, like bigger? What are you not? I keep saying to myself. So finally I went and did it after 5 years of no raft. I ordered a double-tubed offshore raft that holds eight people with everything in it. And it just arrived, I was told, at the – I had the boatyard pick up the boat, and they just installed it and sent me pictures of it. I haven't even seen it yet. I don't know. I'm looking at it. You know, there's something so familiar about a vessel you've gotten so used to. But listen, wait, listen to this. It shows you what's in the offshore equipment pack. Now, I'm not going to read everything in there, but this is interesting to me. Now, imagine you're offshore in a yacht, and she goes down, and you pull a cord. You know, you open the container on top. It's all vacuum-packed tight into a small container. You throw it overboard, and the cord, it's a rip cord, opens it up, and the thing goes whoosh. It inflates itself, and then you got to jump in somehow, swim in, blah, blah, blah. Now, you get in there. It's got all this stuff in there. It's got a roof on it. Listen to what's inside this package. Manual pump, repair kit, bailer bucket, two sponges, two paddles, signal mirror. Wait, listen. Whistle, flashlight, all of the stuff you'd expect. Orange smoke signal, drinking cup, retaining line. Wait, it's going to get better now. Water rations of 16 ounces of water per person, anti-seasickness tablets, first aid kit, fishing kit, raft knife, utility knife, Bible. Survival manual. Wait, let me go over that. Raft knife, utility knife, Bible. Ooh, they put a Bible in a survival raft. Well, there's an old statement that there are no atheists in a foxhole. I wonder if it applies to there are no atheists in a survival raft. I'd like to be in a survival raft and see who the atheist who voted for Obama prays to. Survival manual, oral inflation tube. That should go over very well in San Francisco. Food rations of 1,000 calories a person, sunblock, nitrile gloves, water storage bag, manual pump, survival manual. I can't wait to get home. Of course, you don't get to use them unless you're about to die. So it's sort of an investment that you hope to God you never have to use. I mean, you know it's there somehow, right? Vacuum packing, three-position canopy. It's like a child getting a train set. Single arch tube, inflatable boarding ram, interior assist ladder. Does it have a television with cable? No. Hemispherical sea anchor, heaving line, 50-foot painter. You don't even know what a painter is unless you're a boater. Retro radar reflective segments. Cape Horn ballast system. Aluminumized urethane valise and so on. There it is. So it has a Bible in it. Would you ever expect that? Why would you want a Bible inside an offshore raft? Isn't it enough that Obama's president? I mean, with Obama as president, there's probably no likelihood that any boat will ever go down. Well, that is any boat owned by a Democrat or an atheist. I would think that maybe Republicans still need survival rafts. But I would think that with Saint Obama in office, there's no possibility that anyone who voted for him will ever have trouble on the water.
Savage.
Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Michael Savage is now going to read White Male Inventions, originally published in 1999 and then reprinted, really, in The Savage Nation. White Male Inventions are trains, planes, cars, rockets, telescopes, tires, telephones, radios, television, electricity, atomic energy, computers, and fax machines, all miracles made possible by the minds and spirits of men with names like Ampere, Bell, Caselli, Edison, Ohm, Faraday, Einstein, Cohen, Teller, Shockley, Hertz, Marconi, Morse, Popov, Ford, Volta, Michelin, Dunlop, Watt, Diesel, Galileo, and other dead white males. All reports indicate that we live in the most wonderful society on earth, but few understand how this happened. I hate to disappoint my friends on the radical left, but it has nothing to do with Bonnie and Clyde Clinton or the Democrat Party, or with any other party for that matter. What I'm about to say is tantamount to blasphemy in this politically correct day and age, yet truth is truth. How long are we going to pretend that origins play no role in our world, the origins of the inventions, science, technology, and economics of the world in which we live? Our present economic boom, well, at the time there was, right now we're still living through great technological booms, is due to the revolution in electronics and computer technology. But saying this is not enough, for these things didn't just spring into existence by themselves. They have traceable origins. And all of our booms throughout history have the same origins as this one. It's no mystery. Just look at the list of names in your history books and their national origins. The great majority of booms, past and present, have been brought about by the genius and inventiveness of that most despicable of genders, the dreaded white male, or to be exact, by specific individual white males. This is not to discredit the many contributions coming from non-whites, but fact is fact. Our most important and consequential inventions have come almost exclusively from white males. Curse me or all white males if you wish. That changes nothing. But if you call me a liar, you'll have to come up with the proof that I'm wrong. Remember, I didn't say there were no important contributions by non-whites. I said the overwhelming majority. Of course, I know about such things as the Chinese and gunpowder. But they didn't take it much beyond firecrackers and pyrotechnics. And I know about the pyramids and masonry of South America and the zero of the Arabs. Would we have atomic physics and electricity if it hadn't been for the ancient Greek philosophers who, for example, had the idea that all matter consists of tiny atoms? Aristotle, 5th century BC, used electric charges to treat gout. Archimedes perceived the center of gravity of solids, cylinders, and spheres. From the basic discoveries of Greek civilization, it went to the Romans, and after the fall of Rome, it passed to later Europeans who expanded on the scientific knowledge. In modern times, these ideas were developed by such Europeans as Volta, Ampere, Watts, Bell, Edison, and Einstein, who provided the basis for most of the technical wonders of today, all of them dreaded white males. Maybe you got your enlightenment from one of the Ivy League institutions of diseducation. Maybe they taught you that it's all the result of white racism and oppression, that every time a potential Einstein, Edison, or Ford popped up in the third world, a white hit squad would swoop down and eliminate him before he had a chance to prove himself. Or maybe their schools refused to teach him in the Ebonics of his day. Or maybe they didn't have proper daycare facilities. Or maybe our would-be innovator came from a dysfunctional family. But the facts tell us that many of the great men pursued their genius at great personal risk, like the astronomer Galileo, who proved that the Earth revolves around the sun. He and other men of genius and courage refused to be suppressed even if it meant their lives. They would permit no race, gender, group, or class to keep them from their pursuit of truth and excellence, whatever the cost. If you eliminate, suppress, or debase the white male, you kill the goose that laid the golden egg. If you ace him out with affirmative action, exile him from the family, teach him that he's a blight on mankind, then bon voyage to our society. We will devolve into a cesspool. Where has there ever before in history been a group of human beings who have brought about the likes of the Magna Carta, the U.S. Constitution, and the countless life-saving and life-improving inventions that we now enjoy? Now, it is certainly true that China did lead the world in technology and commercial inventiveness about 1,000 years ago. They had great coal mining operations, gunpowder, six-masted sailing ships, and intense commercial enterprise. But it all collapsed because the elites, the long-nailed mandarins, centralized control 1,000 years before Mao Zedong and crushed the expansion and inventions of China. Does this mean we should sit back and let ourselves be governed by someone just because he's a white male? Of course it doesn't. It means simply that we shouldn't suppress anyone, including white males. Let our God-given gifts run freely in a free and just society, free from the oppression and tyranny of social engineers. If anyone has gifts beyond our own, be a white male or other, be grateful. Maybe we have gifts that in some small way can contribute something of value as well. One way or another, we're all in the same boat. Few of us have truly outstanding gifts, and most of us have to humbly accept that there are others around who are more gifted than we are. In a democratic society, it's not for Big Brother or Big Sister to decide who shall thrive and who shall struggle in the hive. Michael Savage, 1999. It appears in the Savage Nation. Many of you responded to that. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. The website is michaelsavage.com. We go to the callers now, New York City, WOR. Bunny, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Your reading was masterful. You sent me a copy of your book after our conversation, and hearing it from your lips, it impacts me even greatly. The question is the hypocrisy that is overtaking America. I live in your Upper West Side in a building with seven-figure apartments. Everyone here is so left, they're off the planet. Their kids are all in private school. You never see anybody on the subway. They all have car services. Mm-hmm. And they want open borders and open everything.
So, Bunny, let me ask you, do these fine pink people understand what happens with their political wants, what happens as a result of their political wants? Do they see Zimbabwe in their future?
No, they feel that we should have compassion and give people opportunities. And there's one young woman in the neighborhood, five kids from five different men, and she says none of the men has ever seen his son, but I love to be pregnant. I'm going to have more babies.
Does she live in the building in one of the seven-figure apartments?
She works in the neighborhood. And then she goes to a city council meeting and says, I need more space. You must give me bigger apartment. And they relent.
Well, a society collapses when you have a society where everyone can vote. Let me be very clear about this, including people on welfare. The society devolves into a communistic society. I have said for years, Bunny, that if you are receiving public assistance, you should lose the right to vote during that period, because you're only going to vote yourself a raise, and that means you're going to ask those of us who work to give it to you when you don't work. It does not make sense to give people the vote who are on welfare. If they regain a living, give them back the vote. No, sir. Now that's why we're falling apart, and that's why the politicians keep pandering to the lowest common denominator, Bunny. You know that's true.
Savage.
Boise, Idaho, DJ, you're up on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
I'm like, I'm only 26 years old, and I can't relax in a restaurant, but what about a movie theater? Those are the worst for me. I just cringe, because right when I sit down, I see a family with five or six kids that just want to talk throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, they think it's their personal video experience in their living room. Yeah, well, totally. In my day, we had ushers that went around with a flashlight, and they put it in your eye if you talked. That didn't always work, but you know, we mocked the ushers, or we threw candy at them, you know. I mean, we weren't all dolls, believe me. But we knew not to talk because the other kids would have gotten into a fight with us if we talked. There was self-control because the audience would have controlled you otherwise.
Well, now I look around and it's like I'm the only one that cares. The audience doesn't seem to care. It's like I'm weird because I'm upset that these parents want to
talk. Yeah, I can't even go to. I go to a movie very seldom. I try to go very late at night or off. You know, I went to two movies in the whole year. That's what I watch at home, you know. What do you expect in a movie theater? The lowest common denominator is in a movie theater. They're not the highest. They're not generally not working people. They're either senior citizens or looking for the senior, you know, the $5 ticket. You ever see them line up at 12:30? The Social Security crowd? You don't want to be in there after a Medicare meal, I tell you that. You don't want to be in that, because they cut back on the air conditioning. You could die in these theaters. I had it in the elevator last week, too, in the building I'm in. You don't want to go in those elevators. It's owned by some conglomerate from Boston. I'm in San Francisco. And they told the management not to put the fan on in the elevator. You could just die if you get in the wrong time of day after the seniors had visited for the medication, whatever they give them, Metamucil. I don't you know, you take your life in your hand in the elevator. What are you going to do? I don't mean when they're in there with you. I'm talking about after they get out and you get in and the elevator starts to climb. What are you going to do at that point? It's like San Quentin. It's like the gas chamber. I mean, there's nothing you could do. You're finished at that point. You got to climb, you know, a certain number of stories. You come out with your eyes smarting and gagging. But that's people today. They don't care.
Savage.
Tennessee. J.D., you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind, my friend?
Hey, Mike, long time, man. I've been listening to you for I don't know how long. Can never get through because you're the hardest working man in show business. But
love it, love it, love it. Well, what made you call? What made you call tonight?
One Arm Frank is the number one stunner in your book. Man, I was in the military, and I had a guy that I knew, man, and his breath was so stinking, man. I'm talking about his car smelled like his breath. The interior in his car smelled like his breath. Even in the cold, we was trying to ride with him in his car. My car broke down. We had to let the windows down in his car.
And wait a minute. You're not saying he had one arm, are you?
You couldn't take it. And when you roll the windows up, it's like it was embedded in his interior. Everything. Man, you could smell him 10 feet away from it. That's how bad.
But I want to ask you something. I'm not being cruel in any way. Did he have one arm?
No, sir. No, sir. But I'll never forget the guy. This guy was from North.
Right, no, but he had a breath on him that I say was a medicinal problem. Like you had to go to a specialist to cure this.
I don't know what, Mike, but his breath smelled like a sewer. It smelled like a bad.
Well, J.D., did you get the book yet? J.D., can you hear me? Did you get a copy of the book yet?
No, sir. That's reading.
Well, you're going to... Hold it. Don't go away. Stay on the line. I'm sending you a free copy, but I want to read you and ask you if this is what you're talking about. I said, in those days... Blah, blah, blah. So One Arm Frank was a very sweet guy, but he had sick breath. Now, I want to tell you, there are bad breaths, and then there are very bad breaths, and then there are medicinal problems. This one had to be solved with a medicine that hasn't been invented yet. I remember one winter my old man was dropping Frank off at his home. Frank was in the passenger seat, and I sat in the back. It was -4 degrees out, but we had a ride with all the windows open. Did you ever meet a person like this? Whenever he spoke, the car filled with a nauseous fume. Are we going past the meat factory? No. Did we run over a small furry creature that got caught in the muffler and the smell shot up through the floorboard? Did I step on something? Nope. I mean, I took my shoes off. No, but it was only Frank talking. Okay, J.D., no, don't go away. I'm sending you a free copy of Psychological Nudity. Everybody loves that story. They don't understand that those, because I think that was before mouthwashes. Nobody, you know, J.D., that's another interesting side story here. In my father's generation, a man would not use a mouthwash or a deodorant. You know that.
Yes, sir. If
a guy used an underarm deodorant in my father's day and a mouthwash, you know that they felt he belonged in San Francisco.
Man, you're the best, Mike. You're number one in the nation.
No, I mean, if they caught a guy and they went in his bathroom, let's say they had to use the John, and they saw a roll-on deodorant and a mouthwash, they never talked to him again.
Man, I haven't seen this guy in years, but I'll never forget him because of his breath. Man, I've never seen the person.
Hey, J.D., let me ask you something. Are you a musician by any chance?
No, sir. No, sir. But I do.
Well, you sure have a musician's sense of humor. I got to tell you that. J.D., a free copy, Psychological Nudity, going out to you in Tennessee because you made me feel so good and laugh so hard. I got to tell you. That's a great call. That is a great call. You see, we can transcend politics, race, generations, all with what? The miracle of humor, the miracle of communication. It is a miracle. It's a miracle, and I'm gifted. I know it's a gift. It goes back, again, not to dwell on the past, but how did it start? And this is not in the new book, but it should be, because it's a very important story. I've told it once in 15 years. First grade, New York inner city school. Play, auditorium. Now, I don't know if you know, there are some people who are terrified to give a speech in front of them. These could be tough guys, tough kids, murder, tough as nails. You put them in front of an audience, their face turns red. They can't say a word. They can't say anything. It's not, I'm not, It's a gift. If you can do it, it's a gift, okay? It doesn't make you better than the other guy. It happens to be a thing you have. It's like another guy can run, jump, throw a basketball, whatever, fly a plane. But talking in front of an audience, so I didn't know I could do it. How do you know if you could do it? You have no idea. But although we were poor, my mother wanted me to look good, so she bought me a little blue suit. It was probably $9. This was before Dead Man's Pants, when we had less money. She bought me an actual suit that fit in my size. It was probably in Barney's Boys Town, wherever she saved money. So I had a little blue suit. So the teacher said to me, look, you're the only kid in the whole school with a suit. I said, I don't know. So she's, get the suit, bring it in, you're going to be the announcer for the assembly. I got up, I saw a sea of people, and I wasn't frightened. I enjoyed it. I liked, it was like a sea of faces. It was, look, it's an interesting thing looking at an audience if you don't panic. It just looks like a sea, like little waves chopping around in there. They don't look like people to you at that point. Anyway, I learned that I could talk to an audience, and that's how it started. That's all there was to it. And it was a gift that I had at that time, and that's all there was to it. Now, I'm going to move up one grade, two grade, three grade, four grade. Now, I was a short kid, and I had gone to school early, then I skipped a grade. So I was younger and smaller than most of the kids. So if I'm in elementary school, and it goes up to the eighth grade in those days, there was no junior high. It was like 1 through 8, then high school, 9 through 12. There was no intermediary school where you learn how to have, you know, sex, whatever. In other words, it was right into the eighth grade. Now, picture this. So in this school of 1 through 8, K through 8, you, not K, it was 1 through 8. There was no K. The K, you were home already with the grandmother who didn't speak English in kindergarten. There was no such thing as kindergarten because the mothers didn't work. You sat around and you watched them make Jell-O or whatever. So 1 through 8, you had kids now 5 years old in the first grade. And in the eighth grade, you might have a dummy who was also left back because of truancy and bad behavior who might be 15. So I had to figure out how to go in there and come out with, like, not being killed. So I found out that I'd go in and right away I'd arrest the guys. They were usually slower. Okay, admittedly, they might have been violent, but they were slow with it. I'd tell them a joke. I'd look right in the eye and point at them and say, hey, listen, that's how I learned to tell a joke.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
1-800, there's a fly in the studio. I'd like to kill it. I can't get to it. Don't you hate flies when they get... And I'm the kind of guy lets flies out of a window, if I can. There's no windows here, no screens. I want to just kill it with a newspaper. In 2 minutes, you're going to hear me running after a fly. I hate flies. I hate them. They remind me of liberals. They always buzz around. They leave fecal matter everywhere. They supply nothing positive to the environment. You know, and they're always buzzing. A bee, I don't even mind as much as a fly. A bee, I never get... It doesn't bother me because I can see a bee. It doesn't weave and bob like a fly. A fly has a certain agility that a bee doesn't. Bees leave you alone, by and large. A fly looks to bother you just because it can. My father taught me a trick, may rest in peace. You take an undershirt off your body. It's an old European trick, and you swing it overhead. You ever see the old men do that years ago? There's no old men around anymore. Where are the old men in this country? You never see them. When I grew up, there were old men around. There were old men, middle-aged men, young men. Today, everyone tries to look alike. With Viagra and hair transplants, it's like one continuum from age 15 till death. Everyone has dark hair, false teeth, and they can be sexually aroused till they go into the coffin. My day, you got old, and that was the end of it. They were old younger, though. The truth is, in my day, 40 was 60. 60 was 40. 80 was 60. I don't know how it happened, so... Like a 60-year-old today is like a 40-year-old then, right? And in those days, they died young at 50, 55, a lot of them. It was like 75, 78. Well, they ate like, they didn't know what they were doing. You ever take a look at their diets? Smoked all day, didn't exercise, didn't take a vitamin, no diet. Never heard of a garlic. They drank the wrong alcohol, you know. So, you know, you can kill any good genetic inheritance with that kind of situation. You could see I'm already... you know what I really want to do is have fun. I am having fun. Maybe it's too much fun. Maybe you want me to just do pure, you know, stuff for you. I don't know. I'm not in the mood. I have a friend of hers that I know from 30 years ago, listens to the show avidly in New York. Now, I haven't spoken to him in 20 years, but I heard he listens. And he actually knows that I really, when I told the story of the midget in the seedy hotel in Florida from 25 years ago, there really was a midget, and he really did rob all of my money and his money, and we had to call the police, and the police were in on the take. Remember that story? AC, if you're listening to this show, would you call and confirm that there was a midget in that Fleabag hotel in Miami back in the 60s? It really did exist. I was a naive kid from New York. We took the Greyhound bus down to Florida. We couldn't even afford a $69 air ticket. So it was like intercession, and we took the – what bus? Was Greyhound, probably. Greyhound bus to Florida. I remember to this day it went on. It was like a midnight cowboy. Right? It was like midnight cowboy. I mean, you know, like through Atlanta, there were like chicken bones in the aisle already. People were throwing food on it, you know, like eating chicken and throwing it on the floor. It got so filthy. Who would use a – you know, you really have to be a hero to use a Greyhound toilet. I would never. I'd rather bust inside than – imagine going into a bus toilet in this day and age. Imagine what kind of needles are in there or whatever. I never, even as a kid, I wouldn't use a bus toilet. My God, the thought of it. The driver was like, he was telling you there's a restroom in the back of the bus? Forget about it. It's like apartheid, man. Take that bus. It was the best fried chicken I ever tasted in my life was, you know, what do I know? Everything with me is food. So I came from New York, and my mother would try to make fried chicken. It was okay, but I didn't like the oil. It didn't taste good. So I figured I'm in Atlanta at the bus stop. I'll try in the cafeteria, the Greyhound cafeteria in Atlanta. Now I'm going to try the cuisine of the South in this place. What did I know? I was a kid from New York. I had no idea. I figured, all right, I'm in the South. I'm going to try Southern fried chicken. Where am I going to try it? The Greyhound bus terminal. It was excellent. It was unbelievable. Those days, there was no KFC. They do a pretty good job, KFC. I've told you that. I haven't eaten it for a while. I got to try it again. I need to, like a hand. Maybe that's why I have a skin condition, not enough grease. You know, I bet you I cut down on the fats too much. My skin became tight. Maybe if I had a high-fat diet. You know what? What if I went to a high-cholesterol diet for a few days? I went and got the fish oil today. The Norwegian, the nitrogen-infused $18 variety. Of cod liver oils from special hippie fish from Norway. Fish that are, they're all socialists. They're not racist. They're not homophobic fish. They danced in certain aquariums, and then they were harvested peacefully in their old age. And their livers were extracted gently by Dr. Death from his jail cell and infused with nitrogen. I actually feel better from it, the fish liver oil. But I don't like it. I grew up on it. Thank God I had fish liver oil as a child. I got to tell you the truth. With the diet I ate, what she put into my mouth, you know how they force feed a goose to make pate? I was close to second in a human form. Well, because they came from poverty in the old world, so they had a little money. The first thing they did was feed you. They didn't intend to give you a heart attack at 12. But it was a cardiotoxic diet. There's no question about it. Ham and eggs for breakfast, meatloaf, a light lunch, meatloaf. From the night before, and at night you had a steak or pot roast polished off with an ice cream. Now, if you do that to an average human being today, they're dead in 3 years. Let's say you wanted to take Al-Qaeda members, and you say, well, here's your choice. We're either going to keep you in prison indefinitely with no charges for another 10 years, or we can subject you to Michael Savage's childhood diet for 3 months. And if you don't get a heart attack, you're free. You know what I'm saying? It's a choice. Now, the reason I think I'm still alive is twofold. A, I inherited on the FEMA, the maternal side of the genetics, and B was the cod liver oil. Because despite the cardiotoxic diet, she gave me cod liver oil. She made me take drops. It was like in a dropper bottle in orange juice. I hated it. I hated the taste of it. It was so disgusting. To this day, it was like remembrances of disgusting things past. It was like Proust in the negative. Drip, drip, take it, it's good for you. I hated it. Take it or I'll kill you. And the scissors came out, or the big knife from the drawer. The soprano scissors were looked at. Her eyes crossed, and I knew I better take that orange juice with the it was less than getting a good wallop, you know, if I didn't take the juice. It was like the Kool-Aid. I mean, you look back on these things, it's lucky I didn't wind up in Guyana with Jim Jones. You know, I mean, take my Kool-Aid, man. Here's the drops in the Jell-O, you know. What am I talking about? Do some of you, are you able to follow Free Association when I get into the jazz thing of the show, or should I stop it? Would you like two dimensions, one dimension, or seven dimensions? You got to tell me what you want me to do here. On the line is a guy I have not spoken to in 10, 15 years, but he knows that the one-eyed midget from Miami story is 100% true. AC, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael.
I don't believe it. It's you. It really is you. I cannot believe it. I heard the other day that you are a listener.
A guy called me. He says, you better call your buddy Mike Savage. He says you should call him. Some bartender called me, the very same guy from 6-7 months ago. Mike, the big question is, do you remember how much money you put in the safe in Florida?
No. How much did I? Was it? Wait, I'm going to guess. In those days, $35, my entire life savings.
Bingo.
No. I made. Are you serious? Was it $35?
We put in the money in the morning. We came back 6 o'clock. He didn't know what you were talking about.
Was it not a midget in a like a shredded midget suit, like a bellhop?
23rd and Collins, man.
23rd and Collins. So is that South Beach today, Arnie?
Well, you know, South Beach, they want to say, is below 21st Street. So it's not officially South Beach, but it's South Miami.
Okay, but did you have bed bugs in your bed?
Of course.
I woke up in the morning, I thought I was hallucinating. There were bed bugs in the hotel. Now, today, I'll bet you that property's worth a pretty penny, no doubt.
But, Mike, you don't remember. You went crazy with the guy. All of a sudden, he immediately found it, or he forgot. He found it.
Wait a minute. Let's slow down. We put the money in, all our money, in the safety deposit box in this flea-bag hotel. We come back. I don't know about no money. I went crazy. Didn't we call for the police?
We threatened to call for the police. The midget eyes started rolling around in his head, the one eye. And all of a sudden, he remembered it was in the back safe.
Oh, I pulled a loud yelling scene in the lobby, right?
Went nuts.
I gave him the command voice and the insanity, and the midget suddenly saw reality. He vaguely remembered the money. Oh, I switched to the other box or something, right? That's right. It reappeared before the police arrived.
He appeared. All of a sudden, he apologized profusely. What can I say? It was incredible. It was
See, but people think I made up the midget in the Miami hotel story. What else? Now, is it not true, and I won't get too personal, didn't you have an uncle who owned a hotel down there, a rich guy?
Got some memory.
Wait, yes or no? Didn't he own a hotel?
Mickey Hayes.
Oh, my. But wait, but didn't he also have a slight habit of stealing the sugar out of other hotels? I remember he owned a hotel worth millions in those days, even in those days millions, which could be, you know, God knows what today. But he had a habit, the sugar and the butter he took from other hotels.
And the plastic spoons.
That's right. You never knew when you might need them because he could be thrown out of Florida any minute. So without getting into detail, I hear you're happily remarried and everything now. I won't get into details.
Michael, I have been wanting to call you for the longest time. I just never, I don't know what to say, but now I get phone calls, call you
up.
Oh,
no, now the next time you're on the West Coast, it's dinner on me. We're going to have a good laugh. Because as I get older, I realize, I mean, time, tick-tock. You know, you can't invent old friends, my friend AC.
And you know this, you know, are we on the radio now? Because I don't even know, but
I hope so. If we're not, I'm out of business.
Let me tell you this. There's one thing. I mean, I go over my Michael, the times we had together. Why can't I get Hakka cuisine here on the East Coast?
Isn't that amazing? From the years you lived in San Francisco?
You took me on Broadway to the Hakka cuisine. There was all.
Oh, yeah. No, you cannot get Hakka in New York with that Chinese community. You never heard of a Hakka?
All I know is you turned me on to the greatest Chinese food in the world, Hakka.
Well, San Francisco has the best Chinese food in the world. There's no question about it. And Hakka cuisine is at the top of the list. It's in the clay pots and this and that. You know, before you go, I remember one of the best memories of my life in San Francisco was when you lived here before the horrible, and I can't bring it up, let's forget it with the taxi thing, right?
Michael, there's not enough time that we have now. You're on your show.
But
around.
But I was there for you, wasn't I? Was I not there for you?
You showed up to see that I was still alive. I had the apartment on 17th Avenue. I couldn't even go to the bathroom. My hands were all in casts.
Oh, I'd like to. That is that where? Let's not go into that person. I'm sure he's a board of supervisor today. Do you remember the dinner your former paramour through in that wonderful apartment, a long Sicilian dinner she had. Remember, she was from Sicily, right? A lovely girl, and she did an Italian meal. Remember I asked for like a Godfather meal, and she did it with like 20 people at a long table. Remember that meal?
Fabulous.
See that? I remember all the good stuff. It's all simple things, AC, let me tell you.
So much, and they asked me what music I wanted to play, and I was all of a sudden, I nutted up. You don't play any Latin music for them on the air, do you? They wouldn't understand.
Oh, yes, I do, once in a while, from the private collection. Our old friend Artie sends me CDs I play. Play Power of a View while AC is on. Let's see if it makes him go. It means to life, and to you I say to life. God bless you. Thank God you're still with us on this planet.
Savage.
Speaking to former presidents, I've spoken to all of them that are living, obviously. President Clinton. I didn't want to get into a Nancy Reagan thing about, you know, doing any seances.
All right. You blew it already. Social worker in a comedy club, day one, line one, social worker in a comedy club. I can hear it. They take away the teleprompter. The guy's up there. He's been a lifetime left-wing social worker with a law degree, an intelligent social worker, far leftist. Now he gets up there and he tries to be cool with the Nancy Reagan seance thing, thinking he's playing to the living room crowd, Bill Ayers, the others, they're smoking dope, and he's trying to do a Lenny Bruce. That's just what America needs right now. The fact of the matter is, don't worry that much about Obama. It's the people around him you better start worrying about. Now, the first one I want you to think about, without necessarily worrying about him, is Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff. Now, why do I say worry about him? Well, it depends about which way you see things as to whether or not you're going to worry about Rahm Emanuel. I disclosed to you, not having had to do much work, but apparently I was the only one who did it. We went and looked up Rahm Emanuel's background, and I don't know whether to say I'm pleased or unpleased. I'm pleased personally to find out that his Jerusalem-born father was a former member of the Irgun, a militant Israeli organization that some would call a terrorist organization. I would call them a militant Israeli organization. The fact of the matter is they created Israel. So if you think that Rahm Emanuel is a pacifist, I got something new for you that you haven't read anywhere. Obama's chief of staff favors compulsory universal service. Now, you know what's odd? If you, and I'm not pushing my book, although I will do plenty of that later, there are very few political stories in Psychological Nudity. But one of them says the draft is coming back. I said in the book that no matter who wins the next election, when I wrote this book a couple of months ago, we're going to have a compulsory service. Now, I read this today and almost fell off the chair. Here's Rahm Emanuel, Obama's chief of staff, saying that he favors compulsory universal service. And here it is. He says, it's time for a real Patriot Act that brings out the patriot in all of us. We propose universal civilian service for every young American. Under this plan, all Americans between the ages of 18 and 25 will be asked to serve their country by going through 3 months of basic training, civil defense preparation, and community service. Now, remember, I didn't write this. This is in a book that he wrote, The Plan, Big Ideas for America, that calls for, among other things, compulsory service for all Americans ages 18 to 25. This is from pages 61 to 62 of the book written in 2006, and he continues. Here's how it would work, writes Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff to Barack Hussein Obama. Young people will know that between the ages of 18 and 25, the nation will enlist them for 3 months of civilian service. They'll be asked to report for 3 months of basic civil defense training in their state or community, where they will learn what to do in the event of biochemical, nuclear, or conventional attack, how to assist others in an evacuation, how to respond when a levee breaks or were hit by a natural disaster. These young people will be available to address their community's most pressing needs. Agree or disagree, this is a bad or a good idea. This is the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255. Wait until all the liberals wake up wearing green uniforms, working for the government and not making any money. Wait till these pot-headed bums have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and shovel manure against a levee. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that one. Although it's not a bad double entendre. 1-800-449-8255. Cincinnati, Joanne, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I love your story about the autopsy.
Which, my first autopsy?
Yes.
You must have a very weird sense of humor if you love that story. What do you love about an autopsy?
Well, my name is German, and it actually means cemetery, so I guess I'm just...
Oh, very nice. Well, you get a free copy of Psychological Nudity. Stay on the line. I am doing an analysis of American politics right now, not an autopsy of a dead nation. And let us assume right now that it's not a dead nation. What do you mean, whose other dog is on the website? What's this? Michelle, line 8. Go ahead, please. Where do you see another dog on my website?
The pictures that you have in Teddy's Corner, there's a white poodle with him in some of the pictures.
Oh, my God. I had asked my webmaster to put up a picture of my boat ride where I'm holding Teddy at night against the San Francisco skyline. I thought somebody was cheating on my dog. Oh, you mean when you go into the website, blah, blah, blah. The other dog, that's Teddy's girlfriend.
Oh, what's her name?
It's actually his sister. Teddy's an 11-pound toy poodle. He has a 2-pound sister. Teddy is the movie star. She's the dummy. He can do tricks. He can almost talk. He understands English. She's like Miss Dumbbell. Doesn't know anything. We keep her shut in the attic. We rarely bring her out into public.
Terrible.
Well, you know, just like humans, they're not all equal. You get that one, Michelle?
The tipping point for the good of this country.